Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I bring to the show people I feel who really devoted their lives to a spiritual transformation in this country and around the world. And tonight's guest, I think, is someone who's really has done that in the last decade or so. I've been aware of her. Her name is Gangaji. She has a new book out called Diamond in My Pocket. And she's going to be doing some retreats in the New York area. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But Gangaji, thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here, Alan.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about the nature of these retreats. I just found the information. So there's going to be a retreat at the Kripalu Center in Massachusetts, September 14th to the 19th. And that's a silent retreat you're doing?
Yes, it's they're speaking in the meetings that we have, but conversational silence is maintained between meetings.
And of course, the silence, I guess, is to quiet the mind. I mean, what do you feel is it that you're hoping to achieve with silence?
Well, one thing is to break the pattern of our day-to-day life, and that's the point of a retreat anyway, is to really step out of the patterns of our life. And much of our life has been in conversation, whether it's internal or external. And if we are willing to stop the external conversation, we can be more aware of the internal conversation, and that's the conversation that rules our lives and doesn't have to. We can stop that also. Mm. But most of us just are running on automatic there, so we need to see it.
Well, I know you're in the Ramana Maharshi tradition, and there's that beautiful line in Paul Breton's book, you know, The Search for Secret India, where he meets Ramana, and he says there was a river of silence that flowed from him.
Well, that's the true river of silence that's in the core of each of us, that flows into the ocean that we're all a part of. And it is possible to discover that, and of course that's what a retreat is designed for.
But you must have dipped into that ocean a few times. I mean, in all the years you've been practicing, haven't you?
Well, at a certain point, I recognize that I am that ocean.
Uh-huh.
And that all of the activities that happen in this life stream called Gangaji are just happening on the surface of the ocean. They aren't separate from the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's just that when you dive deeper into your core, you discover a depth and a silence that is endless, that is the same as Ramana, the same as Papaji, the same as Alan or anyone else. And that's quite wonderful. That's what I recommend for everyone.
So you've discovered that, but yet the life of Gangaji is the noise. It's the surface that you're still living in that. I mean, what's the difference between tapping in and realizing that and also having the noise that is Gangaji?
Well, I'm an ordinary person. You know, I have an ordinary life. I still have opinions and I have preferences and I have all of the emotions of any ordinary person. But I've recognized that to be the surface, and at any moment, in a split second, just looking deeper under any opinion or any emotion, one can come to rest in the truth.
Mm.
And that's fulfilling. So I would say I've been very blessed, and I have a fulfilled life.
I think you're doing what you love to do. But I guess the question, and the question I have for a lot of teachers, is if you know that you're that, then why do those opinions and emotions, why are they, don't you transcend that? Don't they just disappear at some point?
Well, maybe they do for some teachers or some people, but the point is they don't have to for the fulfillment and for the realization to be present.
Hmm.
So I was operating under the assumption that everything had to disappear, and that's what I was searching for. And when I met my teacher, Papaji, who had been with Ramana, and was a disciple of his, he said, just drop all of your concepts of what enlightenment is, of what ignorance is, of who you are, of who someone else is. Just drop all concepts. And when I dropped all concepts, which anyone can drop in an instant, I realized that there is this transcendence, maybe is not the right word, because it's actually closer than thought or closer than emotion, closer than concepts, is always here. And so that for some people then, maybe they never have another thought. And for some other people, maybe their minds are as active as they always were. But a shift occurs, and that's then secondary to the shift. So I think I'm just like regular people. I don't think you would notice me as looking any different if you saw me or if you didn't know I was a spiritual teacher. There are people in town who just relate to me as a regular person. And I'm happy to be that. That's the way my teacher was. He was a householder and just walked among people, but the grace of his presence and what he was pointing to was an invitation to discover yourself in the depths as you are right now.
Mm-hmm. And that has been sort of the, I guess, the guiding force in your satsang, or the guiding place to return to.
Yes.
But, yeah. But then I'm just curious about the phenomena of where those, if you know that, then because maybe I've only touched that occasionally, and when I have, it's like, and then it's not my daily focus. I love being in the world. I love having opinions, actually, so.
Well, I have to say I do too, you know, and they aren't separate.
But then I haven't touched that place maybe as much as you have, and I think, well, if I had, I probably wouldn't care for my opinions as much as I think
well,
I do.
Well, you wouldn't. It's true. You can have opinions and even enjoy your opinions without believing that they are in fact the truth.
Mm.
You can recognize that they're just some result of a compilation of innumerable factors. In this Allen-ness, mm-hmm. and rejoice in that, because that's not separate from the depth that is totally opinionless. But when you recognize the depths, as you know, when you taste that, then your opinions are, you know, they're just like little gnats flying around in the sky. Mm-hmm. They're a miracle in themselves, but where they come from is the bigger miracle.
But also, the identification with them, I think, is what separates people who have touched that place. And I don't identify. I mean, I like my opinion, but I don't identify with them as me.
That's right. That's the key shift. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And if you do identify, if anyone identifies with their opinions, there's great suffering that's unnecessary.
Mm.
You can have opinions. You have a body. You have a life story. But to identify with that is to suffer unnecessarily.
And yet, you probably still suffer in relationships and situations, or do you not?
Well, I have pain. I make a distinction. Pain is an experience. I can definitely be hurt in relationships or physical pain, emotional pain, or the global pain. I can definitely experience that and do experience that. But for it to be suffering, it has to have an ongoing story attached to it, rather than just the pure experience of the heartbroken or the reading the newspaper and empathizing. So there's a way of hurting fully so that you don't suffer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really a good distinction for me. You're right. I get that. And you know, I've always felt like I wasn't so identified with whatever my identity was. I always felt like, in a way, an observer. It's like, so what? There's a drama. But it also feels like I've also been then very detached from the world in a way that was not as feeling as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my own internal maybe conflict. Do I stay detached and observe the emotions, or do I be in the emotions and let myself, in a way, live the life of the emotion?
Well, you know, in a sense, we have real freedom of choice there, and we're also all made differently so that we have different affinities. Some people are more emotionally inclined than others, and some people are more mentally inclined, and some people may be more physically inclined, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a variety of form. But if your detachment, say, is actually a strategy of escaping the depths of your being, or if that's a result of that strategy, then it's in the way, and then it is a problem, and I would say at that point it is important to open to feelings. But for some people, feelings can be a way of avoiding the depth under the feelings, and so feelings get traumatized, but there's something under that that never gets touched, that is the calmness, the peace of being.
Right. No, I get that. I think you're right. People definitely have used feelings to avoid whatever they are. And you know, this thing that we're talking about, that we are, it's in a way so obvious. It's so...
Yeah.
it's just right here all the time. And we... Yeah, this chatter is so loud that it drowns out the stillness and the being that we are.
That's right. And that chatter is generally, and 90% of it, recycled chatter. It's the same chatter that we go through every day, going through our same opinions, or reaffirming our same opinions, or judgments, or evaluations. And so the creative thought never really has a place or the space to reveal itself, and the willingness to retreat from that chatter is very valuable.
But in your life, I mean, I'd love to, you know, see, talk about people who are in and out of that place. You still have the chatter, like you said before, and you don't identify with it, and you, in these retreats for yourself, is there a new place that you always reach, or what is it that you're going for in your own retreat?
Well, I go for meeting the people who come, because in our meeting and in the interaction we have, whether it's in a conversation in a general meeting or just sitting in silence together, there's a communication that happens where we actually, maybe in terms of the brain limbically, connect with each other. And to me, that's always fresh. And I never know where the meetings will go or what the conversation will be. I know my purpose is to point to what's under all the conversations, what is perpetually at peace and still and quiet, regardless of the conversation. And so I have a particular role that I play, but the role is really, is minor in the face of the synergy between all of us who gather, and some kind of divine mystery that then supports us in discovering this silence and the peace and the realization that is actually, as you said, always here and in the most basic ways obvious, and yet somehow gets overlooked in our day-to-day life. So that's thrilling to me. I look forward to these meetings, and it's I'm a student at these meetings. They call satsang, and my teacher said no one gives satsang. We only can attend satsang. Mm. Satsang is what arises from the willingness to discover truth.
Mm. And the teacher I had said this thing that we're talking about is closer than your own breath. It's
yes,
yeah, and
yes,
it's so close in front of your nose that we don't recognize it.
That's right. That's right.
And I think I really liked what you said when you talked about this coming together, because of course, if consciousness is one and we all drop into the place of that oneness, then what's the purpose of the other? But you're saying there's something that happens when consciousness meets itself.
Yes.
And what is that? Describe that.
I don't know how to describe that, but it's alive. It's life recognizing itself in the freshness of this moment, knowing itself as before time is ancient, and yet the recognition is absolutely fresh. And this, to me, is what's meant by the living truth, that it's not conceptual and it's not something we can learn or even remember, but it is present and is reflected by each other. I think that's why we have each other. I think that's why there are multiple forms, so that we can discover that singularity which includes everything in this mandala of variety. And that's the mystery of life, of human life and all life.
And it's what the mind can understand. The mind can't get that because the mind is trying to figure it out.
That's right.
And it's like I've seen that spark of stillness. And what happens when I recognize it in another, it's as if a light comes out of their eyes and there's a moment.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Such a moment. It's love, actually. You know, it's love. It can happen in nature, and it's wonderful. But when it happens with human beings, it's somehow consciousness really recognizing itself in this human form. And many of us live in self-hatred of our own form and of other human forms. And so it's a healing to see that same light of consciousness in someone we may know nothing about. We may know nothing of their history or their story, but we see that that's alive and that's true. And that has great effect in one's life, and certainly in my life. So I have these retreats and these meetings so I can attend them.
So you can attend. Well, you've been doing it for, how long have you been on the road now with your satsangs?
Well, about 18 years.
And you're not tired of, in a way, tired of traveling and doing it?
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes I get road weary, but physically, but it's absolutely thrilling to me. It's the best medicine in the world, and
You went to the home and say, go ahead.
Sure, and I was just going to say I have the most blessed life I can imagine.
You don't feel like saying, okay, that's enough, I've done it, been there, done that?
No, it's never been like that for me. Because it's never the same, even though it may appear the same, or the same words, or the same format. It's always fresh, and that's the living truth. It is always fresh, always alive. It's true love.
And yeah, it feels like love sometimes in an audience, in a satsang. And what is it then that so you're in this place and you're being, but then something has changed for you over the years. It must have.
Yes.
Is that?
It changed for me radically when I was with my teacher and then afterwards, and then it's also changed over time. And that's just a deepening trust in some inexplicable mystery of being. And luckily, I know my life has been given to service of that. And while I don't know what the outcome will be, what the form will be, or whether even what the real effect will be, I know that somehow I'm where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And the peace that accompanies that, whatever upsets that happen in my life, like in any human life, they're secondary, and they just wash through that. Mm-hmm. And that's possible for everyone. I don't feel I'm special in that way. I really am an ordinary human being with ordinary limitations, and that to me is the extraordinary good news, that anyone who's really willing to really inquire deeply into the depths of his or her being can discover this same peace.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you're ordinary like everyone, and so everyone is ordinary, and yet what makes you perhaps different is that you're going for this. This is your life. It's not the conversation. It's not the fame or the money or whatever it is that drives the normal person. There's something else that's driving you for 18 years, and that's not ordinary. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, when I look at my life, I can see that there has been a deep call within me for a long time that I was afraid of. And, I mean, even from when I was a little child. And it was a call to surrender to some divine love. And it was terrifying. I thought I wouldn't lead a normal life. And for me, at that stage, I thought it was a normal life that would give me happiness. Mm. And so I tried to live a normal life.
Right.
Tried lots of different ways to live a normal life, and I kept still yearning for something deeper. And finally that yearning got so big that no matter what I did successfully in the world, it couldn't satisfy that longing. And that's when I consciously prayed that I be shown a teacher who could point me to the truth or who could reveal the truth. Even, Alan, if the truth was that I was deluded and that there was no possibility of a real enlightened life or a life of service, because I didn't know, you know, am I just in some kind of trance or is there a possibility to live a fulfilled life?
And then you met Papaji, yeah?
Yeah, I met Papaji.
And what happened in that meeting that changed everything?
He told me to drop my story of who I think I am. He told me to stop following my thoughts. He told me to be still. And I thought I understood what those phrases meant, but the more I let them in, the more I saw how all of my searching for happiness was actually taking me away from what was already at peace within myself, which is very simple, actually.
And then you realized you were there in a way because you must have touched it even younger in your life in order to recognize it.
Well, I think that we have all had taste or glimpses, and we've attributed certain causes to those taste or glimpses. And so when I was with him, he really directed me to cut the cause and effect equation. And in that, then, there was a recognition of a joy of being that needs no cause. You know, I could say it was because I was with him or because he told me to stop, but what has proven true over time is that whenever I direct my attention into the depths of my being, that a joy, which is sometimes ecstatic and sometimes calm and sometimes very sober, but it's still a joy of being, and it's always here. And
right,
then,
you're not always directing it in, and that's why I'm curious, like I asked before, why not? Why is it not always, why is that joy not, if it's there, if it's the thing you're going for, why is it not always there?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the thing I'm going for.
Oh.
I discovered it's the thing that I am.
Right.
And so, since it is who I am, I'm also, whatever I'm doing, even if I'm having an argument with someone, I'm not disconnected from that. That I have to go back someplace. So, with my language, I just said I can direct my attention in. But it's really just, it's here. I am here. I am here. And I am that joy. And I have many, many aspects. And one of those aspects is a very human, ordinary life with opinions, as we were speaking.
Right.
It's just an aspect of that joy. It's not separate from it. It's one with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of paradoxical to the mind to figure that out, because we have it in our minds as usually either or this or that. But the great gift of really non-dual understanding is that it's all of a whole, that there's room for all of it.
Is that really the meaning of Advaita, the non-dual approach, is that it is all, always, whole?
Yes, all is one, always is. Only God is an Advaita statement, a really great Advaita phrase. Well, it's before Advaita, it's Vedanta. It's that the world is not real. Only God is real. God is the world.
And God is what in the Vedanta?
Is the word is divine.
But it's
only the
things.
Divine is real. The world is not real. The world is divine.
So it's a kind of koan for the mind. You know, it's like a kind of paradox.
It's a resolution. It's an invitation into what's deeper than thought, where that is obvious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we make up the world, but our very capacity to make up the world comes from this divine spark that is alive within each of us.
So it's all always perfect, and I guess it always, always, always is, right?
Well,
or
I'd say there's also the capacity for imperfection in there, too. I wouldn't rule out imperfection.
Well, what's imperfection if it's all always divine, right?
I mean, well, who says divine can't allow imperfection, though? That's a concept of divinity means equals all perfect. But what if divinity includes imperfection?
Well, I guess it's about definitions, I guess.
Yeah.
Finding.
But then it's dynamic and alive.
Mm.
And there's actually room for all kinds of lives and room for creativity and room for mistakes.
Right. And I guess, and so, so if a world was to live these principles, how do you envision that world being? You know, if it was run by this as opposed to people's chatter. I mean, isn't that your, and maybe not hope, but isn't this why you're doing in a way to...
Yes. The world would be at peace.
Yeah. Even though we'd have arguments and imperfections, though.
Exactly. We wouldn't have to go to war over our arguments.
Mm.
We could have, you could have disagreements, but you don't have to resort to war. And you don't have to be terrified if your neighbor disagrees with you. You know, because there's room for the animal nature. And there's even room for fights. I mean, maybe we have more sports and less war. I don't know. But I know that my aim, definitely my intention, is that all beings discover within themselves this core of peace and live from that.
Yeah, live from that always. And,
yes.
And have that as the foundation for a new society, in a way.
Yes, that would be beautiful. But, you know, I don't think much of outcome, because all I know is that if you hear me, if someone listening to me hears me, if someone on retreat hears me or in a book signing hears me, and then they really investigate that for themselves and discover it in their particular way, in your particular way, then that will reverberate out into your sphere of people or to someone who's listening sphere. And there's something then immeasurable in that. And who knows if it happens in this lifetime or in 100 years from now. Who can even say? So I know that it seems that humanity is at a precipice. And so there's a kind of urgency that's in the air, which can actually facilitate a deeper listening and the capacity to investigate and to discover, is peace alive in my core? Because I'm really not preaching that it is. I'm inviting people to investigate what is under all of your thoughts, what is under all of your emotions, and then to investigate at any moment in your day, whatever is happening, if you check, is that still here?
Mm. Well, yeah, and I get that, and I know it's always here, but I think someone who maybe is not familiar with the conversation, what would be the thing you would want them to get first? Someone, you know, who's out there watching the football game but suddenly hears you, what is it that they have to be kind of, what's the first step? Because I've forgotten what that first step was.
Well, I believe really the first step is some kind of desire to know what is bigger than one's own life, or some kind of taste that has come out of the blue or in some moment of something that is bigger than one's own life. So there has to be something that's already been started deep inside. And that leads to questioning, maybe listening to programs such as yours and picking up certain books in bookstores. So there's already a certain kind of attention that is turned toward discovery. And so my job is really just to support what started all of that very deep inside and to direct any individual's attention back to where that started. It starts differently for different people. But it holds it all already. It's like it's already complete when it starts. And our mind just makes a journey back to that beginning.
And more people are becoming aware of that. I mean, don't you think the whole consciousness has shifted? I mean, look what Oprah is doing, right?
Yes, it's beautiful. I do.
What do you think of other teachers like Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie? I mean, what's your...
I think they're all wonderful. I really appreciate the work they're doing. And especially Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie, because we're really speaking in the same type of non-duality. But also the Buddhists, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, whoever is really working to address some deep spiritual longing in people. I absolutely support this. And there's a danger in it, of course. There have been periods of time historically where people have been on the verge of awakening, and then it has been co-opted by, well, I think fascism co-opted it in Nazi Germany.
Uh-huh.
And so one never knows, you know, how it will go, but we are in one of those times where people's attention is being drawn to the fragility of our earth, to the fragility of our particular lives, and in that there is something breaks open. The status quo gets rocked, and something breaks open, and there's a possibility of investigation. And we're lucky that we live in one of those times. It's maybe a dangerous time, but it's also a time of great...
It's very exciting, isn't it?
I mean, yes, it is.
To either be there when the whole world wakes up or the whole world falls asleep, right?
Yeah.
I think we're moving towards the awakening of a new society. I mean, that's why I call my program New Realities, because it's the hope that we can live in a different type of connection with each other from that place that you're talking about. That we're all trying to remember. We all know that we are. Once we discover it, you say, yes, of course.
Yes, well, I support your program, and I'm so happy it reaches so many people.
Yes, and then you are going to be in New York on the 12th to do a book signing at East West, right?
That's right.
At East West Books at 78th Fifth Avenue. That's south of 14th Street in New York City, and then you're going to do a silent retreat at Kripalu. There's this one from the 14th to the 19th, but people can go to your website, gangaji.org, gangaji.org. But no, there's just a few more questions I'd love to just talk to you about. Well, just also about these, I'm just curious about these other, have you met Eckhart Tolle?
I have met Eckhart. We were part of a group symposium a few years back, and he's a very beautiful being, emanates a beautiful light. And I've met Byron Katie a couple of times also.
So
beautiful beings.
Right, so when you're with these beings that that it seemed to me have dropped pretty much out of the normal conversation and actually seem to live in that place and connect with that joy, does it light you? I mean, how are you affected by that?
Well, it's enlivening, because there's a certain intensity of focus and non-attention to distracting elements, so that you're just right there with someone. And Eckhart and Byron Katie are very good examples, because they're really different types of people. She's very extroverted and he's introverted, and but there's a luminosity. And, you know, I don't make the distinction between enlightened and unenlightened people. I don't find that useful at all. But I do know that I can look out in a group, and if someone is on fire with just this light that is aglow within them, it fires me up too. And
right.
The same thing can happen in the supermarket, or the same thing can happen any place, you know.
I have to say, the same thing happens sometimes with you. I mean, where people are fired up by your presence, I'm sure.
Yes, well, that's it. We can support one another, either in being fired up with a in love with this divine mystery, or we can support one another in spiraling down into a hopelessness or pain or the suffering of the world. And so I would never discount the suffering of the world, but I know that we can be in solidarity with the peace that's in the core of us all. And in that, there is a transmission that goes from person to person and group to group, regardless of whatever is spoken, if anything is spoken.
Right, but how do you maintain, I would say, sort of an ego balance? For instance, when you obviously are in that space, you light people up, and maybe it's not you, it's that space that does, but then it's you that's traveling around and doing this, and this is your mission, and yet how do you remove your ego from saying, it's me that's doing this?
Well, life takes care of that. Life is humbling in itself.
Right.
So, especially if you're traveling around and airline agents, ticket agents don't care who I am.
No, but people are inspired by you, and it's beautiful because you're lighting people up. But you know, maybe the ticket agent doesn't care, but the people.
Well, that's the balance.
Yeah.
You see, so it's part of really. I'm very happy to live an ordinary life because I do receive humblings that ordinary people receive all the time.
Well, but how do you maintain the ego within the satsang, or maybe maybe it's irrelevant, the question, I don't know, because people are idolizing you, they are making you into something.
Well, I'm idolizing them, so
okay.
Maybe it just pulls itself out. Well, we're in love, you know, and...
But you know what I mean. People do.
I do know what you mean.
And then how do you put? How do you not? I mean, of course, you don't want to be idolized, I suppose, or made into a guru.
No.
But people do it anyway. Yeah.
So I can remember early on when I was having a meeting, and I think it was maybe the first really big meeting where over 100 people were there, and I could feel a certain energy in my body of like, wow, well, this is great, you know. I mean, when we say puffed up, I could actually feel myself puffing up. It was so obvious, you know. It's so obvious that I was puffing up.
In an ego way or in a kind of
conscious
way?
In an ego way.
Okay.
In an ego way, but it was conscious. That's
uh-huh.
the thing. It, when you're conscious of the ego. And
uh-huh.
so there was inner good energy coming toward me, and I was liking it, and I was doing something, I don't even know what the thought form was, but it was something where I was owning it in a way that was egoic. But you know what? It was a burden. I could feel the weight of that. And at that point, we all are in some kind of situation that has some similarity to that. There's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I didn't want the weight of anything. I was in a meeting where we were speaking about spaciousness, and why would I add the weight of this person, Gangaji, to spaciousness when at my core I am spaciousness itself?
Yeah.
So I guess my point is that the ego does get stimulated, but it's obvious. And if it continues for any time, it gets humbled,
right.
Just like with all of us.
Right. No, I know, and I'm sure, and I know there's been humbling, like, for everybody, yeah, but... you know, actually, this opposite has happened to me in the sense where I used to not let the acknowledgement in if I would give a talk or something. And then when I finally actually let it in, I felt an amazing rush through my body of just letting myself have the acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm. You're letting the love in.
Yeah, exactly. But I wondered at that moment, well, I wasn't, where'd the ego go? Where'd the ego?
Yeah. Well, the ego, in your case, I think the ego was a part of this maybe self-deprecating or the fear of acknowledgement or fear of narcissism because
we
are afraid of megalomania. We've seen the horrors it can do. But so then we go to the other extreme, and it's all about making the superego the jailer of the ego, but that's all still ego. And so if you're just willing to open up, to let it in, and willing to recognize when they're mistakes, then there doesn't have to be a super ego with a whip judging each feeling that arises.
Right, and in my case, it was just saying, okay, I'm going to just let go of the ego that's protecting itself.
Perfect.
And it's love. It's love. And I guess where the ego is, there's no room for love in that way.
That's right. Well, the ego says, this is my love, or I generated this love, or I get this love. And love is free of that I.
And it must be constantly challenging then for you, because, you know, you are up there and people are loving you, and so you're really, are you really on top of yourself all the time saying, oh, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me?
No, I don't say anything.
Oh,
it
okay.
is me. I am love. I am love, but it's also you. You're love too. It's not me exclusively. I don't have an exclusion on anything, but everything is included, and I'm included, and you're included, and there are people who love me and idolize me, but there are also people who hate me and demonize me. So maybe it gets balanced there.
Well, both ultimately don't feel good, I mean, I guess.
They're ultimately both just stories that are circulating on the surface, and
right.
in the willingness just to open to whatever the feeling is on the surface, there's a revelation of a deeper peace that really is pure love, that doesn't know my name or your name, but just exists to find itself in each of us.
Well, that's the thing. Don't you want to wake up one day and not be Gangaji with the responsibilities, whatever it is, and just be love?
I wake up every day. I'm not Gangaji. Gangaji is a name I wear, you know. This body is a name I wear, these roles. I mean, some people know me as Tony. Is there any difference between Gangaji and Tony? No. And
right,
neither one of them touch who I am. So I've already waked up to not being that person. I mean, that's what happened with my teacher. I thought
right.
I was a particular person who had to get something, and he said, stop.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get anything. Don't move. And I recognized that what I was trying to get is what's always here.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, was the waking up and not having to be this particular person living a particular life. I was exhausted with that in my life, and it was a good life.
Yeah.
But because it was built around an identification of being a particular person, it was a life that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to ask you is in sort of states of consciousness where you do recognize that oneness is, I find for me, there's a shift in awareness. It's as if the world looks different. It's almost like being high or drunk or something.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen
mm-hmm.
to you?
Yes, there's a radiance in the world. The world is alive. The world is God.
But it's a shift in inner consciousness that
isn't it beautiful?
Yeah, but I do want to stay at that place myself when that happens.
States change, you know, that's the nature of states. Because the moment before that state appeared, it was not. It appears and then it will end. So then what is really important is what doesn't appear and what doesn't end, what is always here. And that's not a state.
It's
all
not
states appear in that.
Because I think that is a state, actually. Because it seems like a state when I recognize what has always been here. That's actually a sort of state of consciousness. Because what else is it?
Well, there is the consciousness that recognizes every state that appears in it, even states of bliss or states of self-recognition. There's a consciousness that is exactly the same in a state of misery as in a state of bliss.
Right.
That's consciousness that doesn't move, and that's divine consciousness that is changeless. To recognize
right.
that, yes, there's a great byproduct of bliss, and we would love for the bliss to stay, but bliss by its nature comes and goes. That consciousness doesn't. It's always here.
So what you're really saying, that consciousness is, in a sense, the observer, as the quantum physicists have said.
I would say it's the observing. It's the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an observer, because it's not an entity. Mm-hmm. It's the space of awareness, the spaciousness of awareness.
And so in that space, of course, the self, the individual, dissolves, and there only is the observing, the action, not the...
Well, the observer or the individual appears and dissolves. Everything happens in that space. Mm-hmm. That space has to be present for anything to be, for any phenomena to be cognizant of, you know, whether it's a transcendent state or whether it's a very mundane state, you still have to have consciousness to be aware of it.
And consciousness is that state of observing, I think is what you're saying.
That's right. Yes, that's right. It's not a state of observing, though, because it doesn't change when the states change.
Why? The state, I'm only saying it's a state of observing because from where most people are, it seems like getting there is also, when you touch it, it's like, oh, it's another state of consciousness. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like
this is why my teacher's instruction to me was so valuable. He said, stop. Stop trying to get anywhere and discover what is always here. Everything else is subject to birth and death. What is always here. That's the only assignment he gave me. And there were enormous states that arose and disappeared in my turning my attention back to its source of attention. But finally, there was simply a recognition, of course, this has always been here. There's never been a moment in this lifetime, whether I was considering myself Gangaji or Tony or a little girl or a grown woman, where this was not present. And what an explosion of self-love then.
That's good, the self-love, because I think that awareness of the self-love is what lifts people also out of the dramas of their lives. And
that's right.
No, that's good. Thank you, Gangaji.
No, thank you. It's a fun conversation.
Yeah, we'll do a television show when you get to New York, okay?
Great. I really look forward to it.
Yeah, and I think, I think it's, it's only good to constantly remind people of who they are.
Right. It's enough.
It's enough, and it's what we're all trying to discover by all the dramas we've created anyway. What am I? Who am I?
That's right. That's right. That's so true.
Yeah, and so this is a direct course to who you are, to who
That's
we are.
Right.
And I would encourage people to go to the Karpalu retreat on the 14th to the 19th and be in silence and recognize that place that is the stillness. And you can go to Gangaji's website, Gangaji, GANGAJI.org, and sign up. And she'll also be at the East West Bookstore in New York September 12th. Signing your new book, A Dime in My Pocket?
Well, actually, I will be signing that if people bring that, but that just sounds true that my publisher just did a new edition of my first book, which was You Are That. It was in two volumes, and they put both of them together and with some pictures and some new material. So that's the focus of the one at East West, but it is an older book in a new format. Hello? Hello?
Sorry, Gangaji, I just got cut off for a second.
Anyway,
we just should wrap up, I guess. Maybe that's the universe telling us.
Yeah, it must be. The universe just wrapped us up.
Wrapped us up and out. But you were just saying that your new book is being, your old first book is being released.
That's right, re-released in a new format.
Okay, then. And The Diamond in Your Pocket is a new book.
Yes.
And I'll talk to you about what that means when I see you, okay?
Good.
All right, thanks so much for being here, a guest on the show, and just sharing, you know, your life. Because
really, thank you so much. I'm happy to know about your show, and I appreciate being a part of it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And all my friends in Connecticut say hello to you from Vistar.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, good. So I look forward to seeing you in New York. Thank you.
Good.
I'm going to just end with this song, The Song of the Soul. Do you know that one by Chris Williamson that I played?
No, I love the first one you played.
I'm going to end with that one and just maybe pick it up somewhere in the middle. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you have any questions, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Please check my website, newrealities.com. This program will be archived there and also on BBS Radio. And this is Chris Williamson and the Song of the Soul. And good night, Gangaji.
Good night.